It is Saturday, August 15th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and personal data storage expert Mark Fuccio from Data Robotics, makers of the Drobo. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on our program, we're starting with geek news, as we do every week. And in the second half, we are speaking about the Drobo, a popular backup and storage solution for personal use made by Data Robotics. And we have Mark on from Data Robotics. Now, Mark will join us throughout the entire show. And Mark, you're welcome to, as we're doing news, participate as you will. The numbers to call in about questions about personal backup and storage during the second half are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or, of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now. Send us email, participate in our forums, whatever you like. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are our geeks. Miles Elam, he's a slacker and political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Al Luckow, a new media architect.
Hi.
And Ben Jaffe, he's a freelance media guy, and you're no longer teaching?
No, this is my first week in a month back in the air room.
Okay.
So not Skyping in this time.
I'm proud of you.
Do I sound better this time?
Yes, but you sound less employed.
Well, I have 1 week. 1 week of teaching left.
Okay, where?
Stanford.
Back at Stanford.
So yeah, advanced game design.
Great. And you do that with Multimedia Fusion, that application?
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really fun.
The only problem with it is a Windows-only application, which I don't like.
I know.
Just
oh, well.
Because I don't have a Windows laptop. Somebody needs to give me a Windows laptop, and I'll be fine.
There's always a catch.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start with some geek news. And Ben, since you're chatting, go ahead and chat.
Sure. Okay. I have a couple news stories that I want to flow into each other. One is that we have actually discovered, NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope, and it's an infrared telescope. Apparently, a few thousand years ago, and we're reporting a little late on this, I admit, around a star, HD 172555.
I know it well.
Oh,
555? Oh, no, I know 554. Never mind.
Yeah, no, I know 55, but not 555.
Yeah.
But anyway, apparently
is that a real star? Because 555 is all the prefix in movies that you use for
no,
a
No, usually it
number.
Starts with 555.
Okay, this
555,
ends, okay.
Blah, 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 blah.
Right, go on.
So, okay. But anyway, apparently a body about the size of our moon slammed into a body about the size of Mercury around this star.
How does it know that?
How
does Spitzer know that?
Well, we detected signatures of vaporized and melted rock, rubble, all kinds of stuff.
So from the amount of material in the atmosphere, not the atmosphere, but the atmosphere of the star, the area, can tell.
And humans are pretty cool, and we've got math, and so we've decided that it seems most likely that these two bodies were probably traveling about 10 kilometers per second relative to each other. No one really knows which one slammed into which, who was at fault for the crash, so I'm not sure what's going to happen with insurance. But anyway, pretty crazy story. Luckily, there are humans on our planet, so that must mean that our planet is safe from things like moons or meteors smashing into it, right?
Exactly. We track all the asteroids and protect ourselves.
Oh,
we're totally fine.
Yeah. Do we? Well, I found that apparently we don't.
Well, that's not good.
No, it's
not. No, I thought we did have a really good program on trying to find bodies that could potentially murder us.
We have a program, not necessarily a pretty good program. We do have a pretty good program as far as tracking asteroids that could cause like global, like planet-wide catastrophes, right?
Okay.
So that would be all near-Earth objects that are 1 kilometer in diameter, which is pretty big, right? Unfortunately, first of all, we can only track 90% of them. And of course, as you approach 100%, it gets harder and harder to detect, all the next ones. But the bad news is that in 1908, there was the Tunguska explosion which destroyed like 2,000 square kilometers of forest. It was over Siberia, and it was 30 or 40 meters in diameter. So we can detect, you know, 90% of
Wait,
the 1 kilometer
that was
wide.
That was 30 or 40 meters?
That was it.
Now, just to be clear, a kilometer is 1,000 meters. So that's a lot smaller, and that took out a major part of the Soviet Union Arctic or area.
Siberia.
No one was living there.
No one was living there.
Trees were living there.
Yeah.
You saying you don't care about trees?
You don't care about badgers? What's wrong with you?
I care about badgers.
I don't even know if there's badgers in Russia. Okay,
oh,
go.
Oh, man. Anyway, there are some pretty bad, you know, diary journal accounts from the badgers about
so,
how it was
any case,
horrible. Flattened trees.
So what you're saying is even though we're tracking things that are big enough.
We're not tracking enough. We don't
have enough
money on this project. In 1999, Congress awarded NASA a $1.6 million grant for it. And since then, there has been no money flowing towards NASA for this. And
that's 10 years.
Yeah, there are a couple other nations that are working on programs like this, but they're satellites that can detect things, but they're not going to be any better than our ground-based observations or be able to detect small
objects. I heard Japan was doing a pretty good job. Oh, no, they're focusing on large lizards. Never mind.
lizards that are in space.
Well, you're talking about, you know, catastrophic
lizards
events,
in space,
you know?
Right?
No, in the water. Come on.
Oh, I like lizards in space better, but in any case,
so we've lost funding for tracking potentially earth devastating.
Congress
bodies.
Has also told NASA that they should be able to track 90% of near-earth objects that are 140 meters in diameter or larger by 2020.
If money comes.
But there's no money coming to the program.
Well,
and the only
reason
that we've gotten where we have is that NASA continued the project on its own. So I think we need to throw a lot of money at this program right now.
And we're not. But Al, what are we spending money on?
Oh, what are we spending money on?
Well, I mean, you know, the human race with science and technology seems to spend a lot of money on robots.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I figured that's something we're spending money on.
Okay, well, let's see.
Smooth segue, Lyle.
I tried.
I thought maybe I'd mention...
Sorry, just to say, you know, whenever we say smooth segue, we just lost it completely. It has to, if to be smooth, we can't mention it.
No, see, that was ironic humor, Lyle.
Sorry. Thanks.
Well, if I'm trying to be smooth, let's see. I can give a space-related robot. There's a robot being proposed. It's one of the entries in the Lunar X Prize that Google does, and it's called the Pico Rover. This mobile robot is designed for the lunar driving around on the moon, but instead of having wheels, it's like a giant hamster ball, and it just creates motion by it's kind of hard to start out, but then it just uses its own force to try to start it moving. And they have pictures of this on YouTube, and the mm-hmm. thing flies. It's a prototype, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's not on the moon. But the
so
thing,
it's basically like a hamster ball, and inside that you have a vehicle with wheels on it. And, of course, it's always going on the smooth hamster.
Right. And since it's a ball, there's no, like, the friction. You know, with a car, you have, like, wheels and fenders and all that kind of stuff where there's all these things can get in at dust. For a ball, there's no friction that there's no places for it to get in, so this thing can go as fast as you want it to go.
So what if it gets claustrophobic?
It could get claustrophobic, but the thing, well, you know, I don't know. This it's a proposal.
Is the ball transparent?
It has a window in it, okay. And the inside stays still, and then you can have a camera looking out the window.
Cool.
And this thing can just go as fast as you want. There's no limitation on
how
fast it goes.
I like the idea of the sphere because, of course, then you're not dealing with the impact of dust and stuff, but I'm assuming it's solar panels are in, I mean, how do you get its power? I mean, most of these things are done with solar panels.
At this point, it's got its own power.
Okay.
But, you know, instead of the
thermonuclear reactor.
Instead of the assembly of little wheels and gears and stuff that it's prone to, you know, moving parts, it's all enclosed in this sealed spherical container.
You think that you'd be able to take the entire sphere and make it solar panel. That could work.
That would be neat. Cool. You'd have a circle. And
all right, so hamsters on Mars.
Yep.
Next.
And since we were having all these fires...
Wait a second. What? So we're working on getting hamster balls on Mars, but not tracking objects that can destroy us. Priorities.
Yes.
Okay, we're going.
Well, maybe the hamster has... They can see the near Earth. I don't know.
Well, we know from Fantastic Four, when you get solar radiation, when you're exposed to radiation outside the Earth's atmosphere, you get special powers. So this hamster will come back with a cape and save us all.
I think there's a movie out about hamsters now that are doing
There is.
That.
They do have balls, too.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of
I mean spheres that they climb inside, you know, hamster balls.
Okay. Right. I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Next robot story.
There's some firefighting robot stories that I was looking for something that was related to firefighting, since everything seems to be on fire right now. Mm-hmm. And I found a couple of them. There's a firefighting robot contest that apparently is put on by Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And they've been doing this for like 10 years, it looks like. And they, people submit from all over the world all these ideas and robots that can fight fires. Mm-hmm. You know, from what I've seen, it looks as if a lot of them are designed to fight fires in buildings.
Yeah.
In our case, you know, the fire is on the mountains and stuff, and
right.
Nobody can get to it.
And to be clear, NPR's coverage of that in the very beginning of the show was a little bit off. It's actually at 30% containment and 6,800 acres was burned.
Right.
In any case, it's getting better.
So that's a contest. So maybe somebody will maybe combine one of those like robotic dogs that I talked about a few weeks ago with a fire hose or something. That seemed like it would be really good.
Well, it's interesting because if you had a whole bunch of robots, like a robot army that kind of lived in the woods around here, right?
Right.
And when a small fire started, they just all converged to put it out quickly before it spreads. Yeah.
They just all take off and then
of course you're going
fire.
Camping and you have fire. You know, you got robot dogs to deal with.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a problem. But
I wouldn't personally want a headless robot dog rescuing me from a house. That would scare me a
an
lot.
Autonomous
especially
robot that does
wait I'm sorry
that you can't knock
that
over.
Would scare you as opposed to the burning house around you.
No, I'm thinking about the little kid under the bed who won't come out, and you know, the
because there's a
burn
burning house around them.
Okay, now I still am scared about you take a robot, you give it smarts enough to go this is fire, uh-huh. and then you give it smarts that says fire bad,
right?
And the smarts of saying this is fire hopefully is really good, because you don't want, like, warm things bad, you know, because
right.
we're warm.
Right.
So I don't know why it always comes up, but anytime robots have autonomous abilities,
it freaks
me out.
Well, I have one other thing I can mention. It's a feature inside of a car that's coming out that's designed specifically for parallel parking. And what it does, it's called Ford Active Park Assist. I've seen pictures of this and video of it on YouTube. It's coming out in the Ford Taurus Lincoln MKS. Basically, what it does is as you drive along the road, it scans for a free parallel parking spot, available spot, and says, beep, spot available, you know. And then you just kind of pull up in front, you know, a little bit ahead of it. And then you press a button, and then the car you let go of the steering wheel. And it's just, the wheels start spinning all over the place. And the car backs itself into the parallel spot for you.
So no more parallel parking needs.
Well, supposedly the robots are better parallel parkers than we are.
I can believe that.
But man, it's, you know,
it's freaky to see
when you're in a car and it's driving and you're not doing it. I don't
wrong,
know. Something about
so
that
wrong.
Doesn't seem right.
And what about the kitten in the back that runs into the street? I mean,
yeah.
It's just,
well,
it's
or
good.
What if you bump a car? Who's responsible?
I don't think the robot's
the
gonna
robot
bump the car.
Bumped
the robot's got to pay.
Ford is.
Yeah.
So you pay the robot to parallel park, and then if it bumps, then it has money that it can pay.
It's impressive. If you watch it, it would probably lower my blood pressure when I'm in the car with certain people who are trying to parallel park.
Where you can just go, stop. You just push a button.
Yeah. But I don't know if I'd do it. I think you're better off learning how to do it, you know, as opposed to having a robot park your car for you.
Al, who do you drive with that can't parallel park?
I can't really talk about it right now because I think she's in the room.
Man, you just got death stares. Okay, so thank you for the robot stories. Robots fighting fires, very cool.
Parking your
hamster
car.
Hamster balls on the moon and parking your car automatically. I'm assuming the parking your car automatically is only on new models that actually have this feature.
Oh, yeah.
And are they releasing it, or is it just kind of in the prototypes?
Oh, yeah, it says it's for the 2010 Taurus. It's a campaign for the 2010 Taurus, an upgraded S. It's called Sync System.
I think you might need to buy a new car now.
Yeah.
Just to appease somebody in the room. Okay, let's go on to Miles. Hi, Miles. How you doing?
Hi.
I've been missing you. I missed you last week. Were you not here last week? Or were you here last week?
I was not here last week.
Yeah, that's right.
I was in the car on the way to Portland. Oh, no, I was in Portland at the time.
In any case, what's going on?
I came across a story, which is Governor Schwarzenegger, who's actually in our neck of the woods overseeing the fire, released the first report on free digital textbooks. This is the Open Textbook Initiative that we talked about in the show 6 months ago, somewhere thereabouts.
And 2 years ago and 4 years ago and so on, yeah.
Actually, I don't remember. I remember talking about it being a good idea, but actually going into fruition was fairly recent. Well, these first entries that have come through, it turns out that of 16 that were submitted, I mean 16 different ones that range from math and science.
Social science.
And this is different groups, not 16 total textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
It said that 10 meet at least 90% of California's educational standards, and 4 of them meet 100% of the standards. What's really noticeable about this, though, is that 3 out of the 4 came from the same organization.
How are they doing it?
They're called CK12, and they are an open textbook initiative where they literally can have submissions from other people and contributing things.
So kind of a Wikipedia of textbooks.
Mm-hmm. And they're a nonprofit foundation,
mm-hmm.
and they have a relatively small staff. So it's surprising that they're basically a front runner right now. And this is it's kind of like the open source movement that you know from software moving into more traditional roles like, for example, textbooks.
Now, see, this is the organization I recall you talking about at one point in the show years ago.
But this organization?
I believe so.
If you remember, that's fine, because I don't.
Yeah, Miles is smarter than he knows.
Okay. Now, at the same time, if you want to learn more about this organization, because those textbooks are free and they're downloadable by PDF, if you want to look at it yourself, review them for errors, or just learn a little bit more about math and science, you can go to about.ck12.org.
And they make all those things available. They're open source.
Mm-hmm. You go to the page and you scroll down a little bit, and it's got a chemistry textbook, a calculus textbook, a trig textbook, geometry, biology, life science, and earth science.
Cool. Thank you, Miles, for that update. All right, let's go on to Ben. Hi.
Yeah. Oh, hey, guys. Have you seen the Perseids?
I did.
I did not. It was smoke in the air above me when it happened.
Really? Wait. That was the 11th, the night of the 11th, morning of the 12th. I guess you missed that day.
No,
yeah, the peak was, I believe, the night of the 11th, the morning of the 12th. But yeah, the Perseids were a meteor shower, and we passed through it on the 12th of this month every year. But anyway, so just to be clear, meteors are the objects that are entering Earth's atmosphere, and meteorites are objects that actually land on the Earth.
A meteorite shower would be a bad thing.
That'd
yeah,
be like hail,
yes,
is what
yes,
you're saying?
That would be very, very, very bad. Well, knocking on wood now, especially considering my first story. So anyway, I want to talk about passwords. So passwords are hard. It's hard to remember all your passwords, and you shouldn't use just one password for all your different, you know, websites and bank and everything. And
but it's easy
especially
to,
with so many now.
It's easy to remember my first name, though, so why wouldn't I want to use that everywhere?
Well, yeah, that's true. You shouldn't just use your pet's name or your name or your last name, and you shouldn't write your passwords down. But here's the big but. You can never forget them, because then you're in trouble, especially if it's your master password. So what do you do? Like, it's kind of a problem that pretty much everyone has to grapple with, everyone. Well, it turns out that passwords in some cases are actually a bigger threat or a bigger security threat than viruses. Channel Insider and CompTIA did a survey, and they said that at least with who they surveyed and what they surveyed, it turns out that the one problem that's bigger than out-of-date antivirus as far as security is poor password management. And so that's, you know, people will put their passwords on sticky notes and put the sticky notes on their monitor, and then everyone knows all of their passwords if they walk by, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy, so... So anyway, just a reminder.
Set a good password.
Set a good password, and that should be more than 3 characters. It should not be 12345, or your password shouldn't be password.
Right.
Like, those are the most common passwords, and they're
horrible. Or the letter A.
Yeah, don't just the letter.
And in that same vein, don't use E.
Or E. Or I. Or no vowels.
Let's talk about good passwords, because it's lazy to talk about bad passwords. But here's a good way to do a password. If you remember a poem from your childhood or a phrase that a parent used to say, pretty long one, like, you know, a whole couple sentences.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
For example, but don't use that one.
Well,
that's not a phrase, that's a word.
And it's also really long to type every single time.
So anyway, you don't type the whole phrase. Let's say Miles is very smart is the phrase. And so we just use the M and the V and the I and the S.
M-I-G-S.
So you do that, and then you take and put a couple numbers in the middle of that. and yeah. that's what you memorize.
And maybe a strange character like a pound sign or an at sign or
right.
something like
And so the idea is that you have a phrase that you know very well that you're never going to forget, and you know your passwords around that phrase. And then that helps you trigger the pattern you set up based off that phrase.
One of the best ways to create passwords, a friend of mine, there's this old Irish drinking song that she heard when she was a young kid. And she never knew the lyrics because they were, you know, all drunk singing it. And so she would learn this song completely verbatim, but none of them were words. They were just sounds. And so she has all these sounds memorized. And so she'll just take a different phrase from this song that she knows that no one else knows.
And spell it phonetically.
And spell it phonetically. And there's a password
and
that no one
mix in some other things.
Yeah. Mix in some
numbers. The reason why we say mix in some other things is you really do need to have some numbers and non-standard letters, like a pound or a dollar sign, because most password writing software stops you from writing a password that doesn't have that stuff in it.
Capitalization is important too.
Right. Okay. So was that all we were going to talk about?
That's all. It's just that
the one
password
thing is
management
you started using a password management software.
Oh, yeah, personally. Yeah. I started using a password management software called 1Password. It is pay, but I'm liking it a lot.
And it's on a Mac.
It lets you, it's for Mac, and it's pretty cool. It integrates with all my web browsers, including OmniWeb, which is the best web browser ever, in my opinion.
Let's take the opportunity to use our social network of the listeners of this show and podcast to say, how do you manage your passwords? Go ahead and go up to a forum. We'll start up a new thread on there. Do you use software, for example? The basic idea there is you memorize 1Password, then you save all your passwords inside the software package, which actually encrypts your stuff. So you don't have to memorize all these little ones. And even that one has the URLs for websites. You actually put them into that. You launch your website from that manager.
Yeah.
It logs you in automatically.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
A lot of times web browsers will manage your passwords for it, but the software I'm trying right now, 1Password, will manage all of your passwords through all of your web browsers, so it's all in one place. It doesn't matter what web browser you're using.
Right. So how do you manage your passwords on your computer, and what software do you might use? Let us know. We can help each other out.
Cool stuff. Change your password if it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, please.
That's totally true. We're going to fit in one more news story. Al, I want to know about...
There's this thing. It's called Tool Link, and this is an RFID tracking device that is going to be attached to Ford trucks. And what it's designed for is so that contractors can go out with all their tools, and they have all these little tiny little RFID, you know, little tape things on their tools. And when they leave the job site, the car will say, "You forgot your hammer." You know, it'll do something. It'll say, because when you leave.
So contractors, when you're doing a big site, you've been working your tools all day, who knows where you left things.
Right.
And you might totally forget them. Right.
And it's actually a real thing. They have a little video showing it, and it's an option for Ford trucks.
Yeah.
But this could be for anything. I mean, if you're like a video guy, you go into video shoot, you got all these expensive things, you know, and you got to round everything up. Or if you're in a band and you've got all your, you know, all that stuff.
You forgot your guitar.
Or, you know, an amp, or, you know, whenever, you know, some effects pedal. I mean, there's all sorts of ideas.
You forgot your roadies.
You forgot your keys on the table.
It's a neat idea.
Yeah, no, it's very cool.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, I lied. We're going to do one more story. Miles.
So a judge has ruled recently that DVD copying software is illegal. This is talking about the real software copying DVD. The thing about it, though, is that so any DVD copying software is now ruled illegal. You can't buy it. You can't use it.
Right. What if I already have it?
Actually, I take that back. You can use it, but it's not illegal for you to have used it because someone who have created it. Okay, let me back up one more time because this is fairly unusual. The judge has ruled that, yes, we can make backups of our DVDs because that is covered under fair use.
Good.
But making DVD copying software and distributing it is illegal.
Even so if you don't make money on it.
Right. So we have the right to make backups of our DVDs, but
there's a Pulp Fiction reference here.
Only if you have the knowledge to write the software yourself and you don't distribute it.
Oh, okay. So if you figure out how to copy your DVD, that's okay. If you use anybody else's software, that software is illegal.
Right. Saying that you have the right to do it, but you don't have the right to any of the means to do it.
That's discrimination. Only smart people can copy DVDs.
The geek inherit the earth.
Just so you know what this ruling is like, because it violates the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That's why they were circumvent copy protection mechanism.
Right. But the Millennium Copyright Act, if you do it yourself and you don't distribute it and you do it kind of personally, you're not breaking the rules?
Right.
Very interesting. All right. That's sad state of affairs.
But that basically says that DVD copying is illegal.
So right now, if you've got DVD software, is it legal for you to have that software?
Because you'd grandfather in, right? Grandfather clause.
Because making it and distributing it is illegal, but I already have it.
Well, so the lawsuit has already begun beforehand.
What if you found it on the ground? You found software. Found the software on the ground.
Well, see, it's not, it's not you taking the software and using it that's illegal. It's somebody making the software. So as long as it's around and you already have it, you're good.
No, that logic is like, well, I found the joint on the ground, and I didn't see someone growing it and cultivating it. But it was just there, so I got it, and I smoked it. Like, that argument doesn't quite work.
Okay, no, but I get what you're saying. But if I'm able to copy my DVDs, it's okay. If I have software that can do that, is it illegal for me to have that software or not?
If you got it from someone else.
Even before this rule went into effect.
The rule is already in effect. This is a ruling on a rule that's already existed.
So basically, it's ridiculous. You can't make a copy, but it's okay to make a copy.
You are allowed to make a copy, but you are not allowed to any of the means to make a
copy. How about if someone writes a book, and that book describes how to write the software to do this, and then you buy the book? Is that book illegal?
Probably not.
Okay.
For the same reasons that encryption wasn't illegal back in the late 90s, because it was considered First Amendment, and
someone that can do the DVD thing, figures it out, then writes a book about the experience of figuring it out, and then distributes it, and then all of us just pick that up and learn to program, then we're set.
And have a lot of time to dictate and type things out again. I guess you could put it into a scanner.
And then I see this. If you have a DVD and you figure out how to copy it, and then you copy it, and then you give me the DVD with the copy, because now the DVD I actually own.
It can only be for yourself.
Darn. There is no way around it. Curse you. Thank you, Miles, for that story. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. We are taking calls today about data backup and storage and recovery and that kind of thing. Please do feel free to call in regarding those topics. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KOSP. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks today are Miles, Ben, and Al. And our guest today, Mark Fuccio, holds a Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering from MIT. Mark has 29 years experience in the tech industry, and for the last 4 years has been at Data Robotics and is currently the Senior Director of Products and Markets. Mark, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning, Lyle. Good to be with you.
Can you give me a quick rundown on what Drobo is?
Yes, Drobo is an external, it's a storage array, so you can put all sorts of data on it. And it does two things. One, it keeps your data safe, so it protects against drive failure. And also, it's like a disk drive that never gets full. You can add more capacity by putting in more drives or pull a drive out and replace it with a bigger one.
So it's when we talk to people about you have to have backups of your system and don't put on your hard drive and don't put on your computer, have something you attach to your computer, USB or FireWire.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of like what we're talking about, an external hard drive, but it has extra features.
That's right.
All right.
Most single drives, drives do two things. They read and write your data, and then they go bad. Sometimes they even do it in that order. And every day, our lives are becoming digital. So we're librarians of huge collections of media, pictures, DVDs. And the problem is that people want to keep this stuff forever, even if they've only paid 69 cents for a song or a TV show. They want to keep it forever. The problem is, again, that disk drives fail. So what we do with our system, it uses a variety of redundancy techniques so that will keep your data safe. So if a drive fails, your data is protected.
Let's talk about some of the problems that it's solving. So, for example, this happens all the time. You buy an external hard drive, let's say a few years ago, and it's 150 gigabytes, and you filled it up with your photos, and it's actually a copy. You've got a copy on your computer and a copy of your photos on the backup. So it's a backup solution. Now you're going to... You're kind of at this place where your main computer is running out of space and you need to get data off of it. So now you go, well, I've got it on my backup, so I'll just erase it from my hard drive, from your computer. And then you do that, and then the backup is only one drive, and when that fails, you've lost those photos. So it's one of those things where you're using it as a backup and an archive, and the same thing doesn't work. So then you have to get another drive to get a copy of it. But when you get your new drive, it's a 300 gig drive. So now you've got a 150 gig drive and a 300 gig drive, and you go, okay, well, I'll put all the data from the 150 onto 300. Oh, but the 150 is filling up. What do I do now? That kind of management problem. We had a call a while ago about they already had an enclosure. They just want to get a hard drive for the enclosure. And it was an email. And we talked about, well, some enclosures don't do that so well because they're actually designed for a certain drive because it's an OEM brand. Mm-hmm. Any case, this mm-hmm. problem is kind of a serious problem.
Yes, it
and
is.
And so so Data Robotics solution is to say, we'll make a box that houses hard drives, and you put hard drives in it, and we'll figure out how to move the data between them and share it. And if any one drive fails, it's going to stay up.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right. So the problem people have is they have a lot of data that they've been collecting for a while and have that stack of external drives. It's a huge challenge, just, you know, a really complex one for them to figure out, okay, I have this drive backed up on this other one, and this other one is backed up on this other piece. And that's just, you know, all sorts of mental overhead and aggravation that no one needs.
Right.
So we have a nice, simple, you know, attractive, you know, external array connected to your Mac, your PC through FireWire or USB, and, you know, it manages and does everything to keep your data safe.
Okay, let me ask you. If I have like the six or mm-hmm. four hard drives that are like this kind mm-hmm. of mix of different things, music mm-hmm. on one, copies on another, and I just take them all out of the enclosures and put them in Drupal, would Drupal be able to handle that? Or Drobo, excuse me. Would Drobo be able to handle that? Or do you have to kind of start from fresh with the Drobo solution?
It's best to start, you know, from fresh with Drobo. Start okay. with two drives, migrate the data in. We see some people, if they have, you know, drives that are, you know, fairly large, that they may take them out of the external enclosures. As long as they're 3.5 inch in size and form factor, standard SATA, which is any drive that's been made within the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, yeah, they can start to integrate those into Drobo.
Can you just add a drive? Like, say I had a Drobo and I had two drives in there, and then I started thinking, oh man, it's getting really full. Can I just go to the store, buy another drive, the correct size, plug it in, and have it be available?
That's exactly the beauty of Drobo. So when you format the first time, you tell it how big you want it to be. We recommend people set it at 16 terabytes. So to your Mac, you know, mm-hmm. it would look like a 16 terabyte drive. Mm-hmm. As it gets full, there's indicator lights on the front. Most of the time, it's green, indicating everything is fine. As you get 85% full, it will turn a light yellow. It will either turn it on an empty slot.
So you said 16 terabytes?
16 terabytes.
How many what kind of drives do you have to have? I mean, is there like 11 drives or something? I mean,
No, there's four drives in it. So you know, you're thinking, okay, the largest on the market today is 2 terabytes. How can this grow to 16? Right. That's the beauty of it. You have a lot of growth path into the future before this device will get full.
Okay, but I don't like the idea of connecting a drive and telling the computer that it's 16 gig when it's, or 16 terabytes when it's not, because if I start copying a file that's extremely large and it only gets halfway through, it's going to get an error. You're kind of lying to the protocol in that situation. Couldn't you just say currently it's a terabyte and then later it's bigger? And couldn't you just increase the size in Drobo software as you get larger?
Okay, so there's a couple of ways. So Drobo, the four-drive unit, is always formatted. You tell it how big you want it to be.
Right.
So if you don't want it to be 16 terabytes when you format it the first time, you could pick a smaller size, like 2 terabytes,
right.
1 terabyte.
Okay. So
can you change your mind?
Yeah, why can't you just change it later as it gets larger?
Okay, so you know, actually...
Is it a formatting issue?
Yeah, when you first format it like any other drive, you have to tell it how big it is so it knows how much file system metadata, you know, OS X should put on it. We find that many people... they're shifting their thinking from maybe the old style of thinking where they think they have lots of drives and lots of partitions to, you know, the kind of the new way of thinking is they just have a very large drive.
Right.
They don't have to worry about, oh, is it here? Is it here? Do I need to copy from this one to back it up? That's sort of all the old style thinking and just, you know, time wasters that they want to get rid of.
Yeah, I get that. And I get the idea of making it simple, just saying it's a really, really big computer. Don't worry about this. But mm-hmm. I don't like the idea of actually the computer thinking it's one size and it's really not.
But it'll warn you, right?
It warns you still, but it's...
But that's a Drobo software that manages.
So the beauty of that is that, you know, it allows it to get bigger just by adding an additional drive, increasing its size.
Is there any management software for this? Do you get to connect to it through USB, any kind of management? Is there software to run it?
There's an optional piece of software called Drobo Dashboard, and, you know, what it does is it allows you to format it, and, you know, it gives you a pie chart. Also allows you to set up email alerts. So if you put the Drobo in a closet or someplace where you're not seeing it, you know, so you're not looking at the indicator lights, you can either see it on your Mac, your PC, or you can get email alerts from the system.
So the geeks of this show for quite a while have had in-front boxes, ReadyNASs. They're now Netgear, I think, owns them. No, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I love it. I mean, it's a network-attached storage. So instead of a USB or FireWire cable, you use the network itself. Mm-hmm. And you actually have an add-on piece that can do that, right? Drobo Share.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is an add-on. And the beauty of that is that you're using more server-level sharing solutions, and multiple people can access the drive at the same time. And in that situation... the drive can basically tell it through those protocols what size it is all the time. And the only thing that's kind of scared me about that is that the failure point now is the hardware box itself. Now, luckily, I have one and Miles has one. And even though Miles is broken right now, if he wanted to get the data off his drives, he could come over with all his drives, could pull all the drives out of mine, put all of his drives in, get the data off of, and so on. So, is yours still broken?
I actually don't know if it's broken, but I'm not using it. Also...
So I don't have a backup now. What if mine fails? So that's the concern, is what happens with the Drobo's package itself fails. You have all these drives in these weird states. You'd have to buy another Drobo to solve that problem?
So, yeah, I think that's the beauty of Drobo, is if for some reason you have bad luck and the unit itself does fail, you pull the drives out and put them into a replacement Drobo. All the intelligence is stored on the drive itself. It's not reliant on anything in the flash of a Drobo controller.
But you would need a Drobo controller.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's the same
just
thing.
Just like you would with any other RAID system or the other product.
Now, what kind of RAID levels are we talking about inside this drive? I'm assuming you're using like RAID 5?
Well, the answer is it depends. We'll use traditional either mirroring or RAID 5, which is parity with striping.
Depending on how many drives are in it.
Depending on how many drives, and also depending on the relative sizes. You know, traditional RAID, the capacity is driven by the smallest drive in the array, and that's why it insists that they're all the same size. Drobo allows you to mix and match drives of different sizes. And because it flexibly will use either RAID 5 algorithms or mirroring algorithms, it'll give you much higher utilization of the capacity of all the mixed-size drives.
How much
in
do you lose? Like I know that when you do a RAID system, you have, like, say, a terabyte and a terabyte, 2 terabyte drives, but you don't really get 2 terabytes. There's some kind of loss there.
That's right.
What kind of ratio are we talking about? Just for people out there who are trying to understand, what's this RAID business?
Okay, so what it does is it writes the data redundantly, and it uses some of the storage space as protection overhead, called a protection tax. The amount really depends on the number of drives within the system. So if you start with 2 drives, you lose 50% of your storage capacity for overhead.
Mm-hmm.
If you have 4 drives, you lose 25%. If you went upscale to our Drobo Pro system, which has 8 drives, it would be 1/8 or 12.5%.
So the more drives, the less space that you lose.
The less the overhead that you waste. Protection that you lose.
It's like N-1 if they're all the same size, and if they're all different sizes.
It's not about the size of the drive, it's about the amount of drives. So it's
But it's N being the number of drives. Take away 1 drive, that's your parity. And that's if they're all the same. So if you have 4 terabyte drives, then you get 3.
That's not how it works.
Yeah, you can think of it that way. That's way for traditional RAID systems.
Yeah,
however,
right.
Traditional RAID systems, they all have to be the same size.
Right.
For Drobo, they can mix and match. And we have a capacity calculator called a Drobolator on our site. So if you go to drobo.com, click the button for capacity, and there you can drag and drop mixed size drives. For instance, if you mixed a 250, a 500, a 750, and a terabyte, in that combination, you'd have, with Drobo, you'd have 1.5 terabytes of usable space. In a traditional RAID system, you have 750 gigabytes of usable space. So that shows the benefit of our flexibly applying these protection algorithms.
The clever solution about it really has to do with the aspect of I have a couple 150 gig drives, and I'm going to buy a new drive, and it's 500 gigs, and saying, well, I can't use a RAID really anymore. You still can is kind of the idea of it.
That's correct.
All right. Let's go ahead and take a call. It's not really on topic, but it is about what we were discussing earlier, so it should be a fun conversation to have. Hi, Eric. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey.
What's your question?
Here.
Hi. Yes, you're on air. What's up, Eric?
It's probably a dumb question, but what's wrong with saving your passwords in a file on your computer?
Other people can see the file, and if there's any kind of access to your machine, then they then have all your passwords. So, for example, let's say a virus gets on your computer and copies all your files to the network to this hacker. Well, then you've got a situation where your bank password is actually in their hands.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if it's in a file that's named passwords.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah,
which happens more often than you think.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea is you take all of your passwords and you protect all of those passwords with another password. And that's what the different password management solutions software, that's what they do. Or you could put all of your passwords in a text file inside of, say, a disk image, which is password protected.
That's what I do.
Hey, how about that?
Inside of a disk image?
Yeah, you actually basically make a storage area on your machine which is encrypted. And one way to do that is on a Macintosh, you can just make the thing what's called a disk image, and you can actually encrypt the entire image. So it's a file that's encrypted on your file system. And then inside there, it's kind of like virtual space that you store stuff in. any case, that's one solution to do it. But basically, encrypting the files is really important, and that's why these software packages that manage passwords are so nice, because they, by default, do that for you, and you don't have to think about it. Except for you have to memorize your master password.
So, in other words, what I'm doing, what I might be doing, you hackers, is it would be okay as long as it were encrypted.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Yeah, sure, bye.
And then you just need to remember one password, which is your master password, and then you can get to all of your other passwords.
Basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, and Hal of Santa Cruz is asking, why not just have a password-protected file, like a single file? And that's kind of what you're doing with your protected file system.
Right.
It's just that it's a collection of files. You could have an individual file, but that also... You could.
Yeah. The reason why I'm doing... The reason why I use a... what is it called? An image. A disk image. When I actually mount the disk image, I unencrypt it. It actually becomes something that's accessible by all software on my machine. So, of course, that's a problem if my machine is taken over when I mount it. Then I've got a problem. But I actually have an application on there that I wrote that I can run and a data storage in MySQL. No. SQL. Something like that. Anyway, I wrote a Ruby on Rails application that sits inside that as well. So that's protected whenever I close it down. No one can access it. That's kind of why I do an image. But that's just me. Let's you know what? We'll go ahead and take another call, because there seems to be a lot of interest about passwords, and I do kind of like it. It is similar to data storage. Yeah, sure, I'll go with that.
It's one of those things you need to do right.
Eric was from Oakland, and Kelly is from Carmel. Kelly, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, gang. How you doing this morning?
Hi.
Good. I got a possible solution for you that one is kind of like if you're an iPhone user, and I know not everyone is, I think. The one I use is called My Eyes Only for the iPhone, because, you know, the iPhone is notorious for really crappy encryption.
Mm-hmm.
And My Eyes Only is this little app from the App Store that you can grab that's like $9, but it's really worth it. It uses strong encryption and a password protection system that, you know, if you use your favorite password once on it, then you can store your passwords on your iPhone very nicely, and it seems to be bulletproof.
Thank you, Kelly, for the recommendation.
Sure. That's one thing. And the other thing I wanted to suggest, too, and this is really the cheap seats way to go, and that is you get a cheap seats thumb drive and put it on your keychain or put it, you know, hide it someplace basically in your office,
mm-hmm.
and put your stuff on there. You can, of course, do a, as you mentioned, encrypt it, but at least you've got a backup and you don't have to call the bank 10 million times each time you try to log in. So.
Great. Thank you, Kelly, for the call.
Sure. Good thing. Take care.
All right, let's get back to our topic at hand about data storage and
sure.
recovery. The Drobo, you're doing USB 2 and FireWire 800 as well as 400, or just 400?
It's FireWire 800.
FireWire,
and also on Drobo Pro, which is an 8-drive array, it also uses USB and FireWire and also uses a protocol called iSCSI. So it connects, you know, through a gigabit Ethernet. So it's a really high-performance system for people doing video editing or large
I didn't know you had that
files.
Built in. That's a mm-hmm. good solution. Yeah.
So I got a bit of a technical question. Right now, the hard drives are up to 2 terabytes,
mm-hmm.
but they are limited by the master boot record, the technology we use for booting hard drives, because that goes up to just above 2 terabytes. So does Drobo have any facilities for going above that, like using the GUID partition table, or are there any plans for that?
Again, that's the beauty, is to your computer, Drobo just looks like a block-level device, so it just looks like a disk drive. So if you use MBR, you're right. On an XP system, for instance, you'd have a 2-terabyte limit. If you use a GUID partitioning for a Mac or on a Vista, you can format up to a 16 terabytes.
Interesting.
Right. I mean, but that's always been the case with RAID. You've been able to get bigger than that. The file systems could handle it. It's the drive partitioning that couldn't handle it.
But
so I'm wondering what happens
but
when...
What you're saying is the partition is actually accessible from the file system because it's
USB drive. And there's
so
no partition.
I'm talking about a hardware limit. When you partition something with master boot record, that drive can never be – the individual drive
and
can
never
be
true.
That.
And that is true. With the Drobo, if you partition it that way, you will only get a 2-terabyte drive, period.
That's right.
Because it looks like a physical hard drive to the file system. So if you do
– You're misunderstanding my question then. My question is, what happens next year when drives that are bigger than 2 terabytes come out? Does that mean the Drobo cannot use that?
Oh, you're talking only about the source. Gotcha.
Okay. So in that case, what you would see is – Drobo would present multiple disk volumes to your computer. Each could grow up to 2 terabytes. So, if you had larger drives become available, and you go 2 terabyte volume, you could get a 4 terabyte, you know, 2 1-terabyte volumes. Put in bigger drives, you get a third 2 terabyte volume.
No, I think here's the question. So I think what we're doing is, if you're using Windows XP with a Drobo right now, 2 terabytes maximum size of the Drobo, it doesn't matter what size drives you put in, because when you format it, that's the format. You could
when you're partitioning it.
When you're partitioning,
not formatting, before you format.
That's what I'm saying,
partition.
But you got to understand that from the computer's perspective, this drive, you do partition, and it is a contiguous one drive. So when you partition it, when you partition it on the Windows XP machine, it only goes up to 2 terabytes because of its limit. If you're on a Mac, you partition it, and you can partition larger.
Unless you have a multi-disk array, in which case you can, from the operating system point of view, you can partition
it
larger.
And what I'm saying is the operating system does not think a Drobo is a multi-disk array. It thinks of it as one physical drive. It looks like one physical drive from the operating system.
That's right. Or it will look like multiple drives to the OS, you know, if you have enough drives in it, so that you go past, on your XP example, if you go past your 2 terabyte limit.
Let me put it this way. Let me put this in a way to make it easier. Remember back in the day before LBA came out, the logical block addressing?
Yes.
And drives were larger than 512 megabytes.
Yes.
And like 640 megabyte hard drives were coming out and the like. And if a system did not support LBA, you couldn't use the excess amount.
Yes,
you
could only that's the same thing right now with a Drobo on XP, except that it does a little trick.
Except, that's right. What Drobo will do is it will present itself, instead of one drive, it will present 2 drives. So as you put in more, you know, larger drives to have more physical capacity, you'll see 1 Drobo, 2 Drobos, 3 Drobos, you're presented to your XP machine.
Because the Drobo knows that XP can't handle, because that NBA...
This is not an XP thing. It's not an operating system thing. I'm talking about a BIOS thing. That's the part where we seem to have a disconnect here.
I get what you're saying.
I'm saying the BIOS on current computers,
yes,
except for Macs, cannot handle drives larger than 2 terabytes.
Right. And so if you take a Drobo and plug it into a system like that, it won't look like a drive larger than 2 terabytes.
I'm talking about putting a drive into a Drobo.
The Drobo, what the Drobo is doing with the drives is a different matter completely. What we're talking about is the protocol between the computer and the Drobo. It looks like a physical drive to the computer, therefore it's only going to be able to partition it just like it could do on the local system.
You and I are going to have it out
now,
after the show
is over. No, you're not understanding.
Okay.
If you want to talk about the physical drives being larger than 2 terabytes and whether Drobo can handle a drive inside it larger than 2 terabytes, what's that question? That's a different question. Can it handle more than 2 terabytes?
That's the question I'm asking.
Hard drives. I know. That's why I was trying to clarify. You're not listening to what I'm saying. So in the Drobo, what size drives can it handle?
You know, it will be able to grow and scale with drives, you know, as they get bigger. Because, again, you know, we're looking at the drives. You know, we use a storage pooling technology. We have a virtualized storage array. So we'll be able to, you know, access drives bigger than 2 terabytes as they come out. You know, on our Drobo Pro, the 8-drive system, its theoretical maximum is 256 terabytes. So in context, drives would have to get to be 32 terabytes in size before that would max out. So that's going to be many years in the future.
Okay, cool.
So I have a question about speed. Like normally when you format with RAID 5 or something like that, you take some kind of speed hit. So can you saturate a FireWire 800 link with a Drobo if you have enough drives and the drives can physically handle it?
So if you're asking about FireWire 800 performance for a Drobo?
I'm asking, can the Drobo keep up with all of the drives as far as dealing with the calculations and...
Yeah, what's your maximum speed?
Okay, so we've seen on the 4-drive unit, we've seen reads of around 55 megs and writes little in the mid-30s. You know, for the 8-drive Drobo, we've seen a hell of a lot faster. We've seen about 100 megabytes of read and write on both Windows and also on OS X systems.
We're talking about backup solutions and how this drive can be used for backup solutions, but I often find I'm working with a lot of things on my computer, you know, video and all sorts of stuff, that I wouldn't... Could you use this drive for, you know, saving your files to and actually using the files? You know, I've got my After Effects thing and I'm just keeping it on my Drobo. I don't have it on my other... I'm not backing it up from my computer.
Right,
I'm actually using the Drobo as my working drive. Can you do that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what we find is a lot of people initially think about buying Drobo for backup, but then they realize that, you know, it's such a huge pool of storage that, you know, almost 80% of our customers use Drobo in a hybrid capacity where they use it to back up, you know, one machine or multiple machines, say in their home, in their office, as well as they use it for primary storage, meaning that's the principal place where they have, you know, the copy of their data.
It seems like a secure place to, I mean, to have your working files, you know, your work in progress. Yeah. I mean, just
The one thing is that some software packages don't like an external drive as a storage. I remember Final Cut had some problems with it a few years ago where you really didn't want to use an external drive as your working environment.
Mm-hmm. Not
it's probably been repaired. It's totally fine.
No, it's definitely not anymore. Yeah, you use it as a scratch disk.
Right.
Just got set up in preference.
Theoretically, it could be faster than your local drive.
You could buy two Drobos and just have one as your backup and then one as your work.
And that's what we recommend is that after you make the investment in protecting your data with the Drobo, second thing you should think about is doing some sort of off-site solution.
Right.
I mean, here we're having fires, and everything.
If your Drobo catches on fire and burns and melts into a pool of molten metal, can you get your data back?
It's the end of the world.
From SoCal, Rich, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. My question is right along with that. I'm real interested in this, but if I have mission-critical data, I need to have some off-site copy of it, too. Do you have a recommendation for what to do there? Like when the fire comes through, do I have another robo, whatever it's called, in another place that I copy every so often? What's the recommendation?
Okay, so we think about it in a couple of ways. One is, depending on the nature of your business and how much data you have, that will kind of drive what your offsite backup is.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people do so-called backup to the cloud or backup to other storage providers. Yeah, that's good if you don't have a huge amount. Say if you're editing video or a photographer, you probably have too much data to do that. But if you're a lawyer or some sort of a consultant, you probably don't have only a couple hundred megabytes or gigabytes. For that, it would be feasible to go to an offsite backup solution. If you have a lot of photographic or other media, then you should think about maybe investing in a second Drobo and using some offsite backup capability.
Rich, thanks for the call.
Uh-huh.
And just to be clear, the way that I do it is I take my storage device away when the fire is happening, and actually I have two copies, one at work and one at home. Two different systems. Our guest today, Mark Fuccio, holds a bachelor's degree of science from MIT in electrical engineering, and he works for Data Robotics. And you can learn more about Data Robotics. Just go to geekspeak.org. And the USB device of the week this week is pre-recorded.
Just because you are trapped in some cube farm in a meaningless job doesn't mean you can't free your mind while you work. Enter the crazy USB device of the week. The mystical glowing USB Aroma Radio and Speaker. Watch the glow of not six, but seven different soft new age colors. Channel your inner self through your middle self into your higher self and then back into, say, your middle self. But the therapy doesn't stop there. It has aromas. You drip oil in the heating element and then you smell oil. It doesn't say what kind of oil. Maybe it's patchouli. It also has a radio. Ah, the soothing sounds that can come from a radio, like my voice. Holistically fight mouse potato syndrome with this crazy new age USB device, the glowing USB Aroma Radio and Speaker.
Thank you, Al.
No problem.
GeekSpeak on KOSP will be here next week. I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now, of course, for Car Talk.